Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One. And thank you very much for joining us today for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with us live, and you would like to see what's going on with the rest of the critters, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. That's the ideal location if you have some observations you would like to share on today's topic, or if there is a question you would like for us to direct to our guest that you don't think we're going to wander over towards, that's a great place to put it as well, because we'll be monitoring it during the course of the program, and we'll be glad to bring in your good ideas. Also, if you have some honeydews you got to take care of and you need to run off halfway through the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or take the shortcut and just subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're new to the show and you want to catch up on what you may have missed, we've got almost 7 years of shows sitting there waiting for you. And speaking of shows, let's go ahead and dive into today's topic. And if you define the Cold War as lasting roughly the 44 years from 1947 to 1991, then there was a conflict in the middle of the Cold War that played into it in a few ways that we'll get to during the course of the next hour. But it was a simmering, slow-burn proxy war in southern Africa that involved to one extent or another many of those nations down there and continues to shape their relationship between those nations today. And over the course of the time, it also involved nations from well outside of South Africa who, for their own reasons and motivations, also got involved in the conflict. And all in the background here were two political philosophies that in the 20th century, especially the second half of the 20th century, defined much of history, but here in the 21st century are both held in disrepute. That is communism and the apartheid government of South Africa. The last decade of the Cold War brought the conflict into fresh relief as part of the Reagan administration's pushback against communist aggression, and that's where we saw it brought into that bigger context in that last decade, and again, something we'll touch on as well. What we're going to do is we're going to go back from the beginning and work up to today's, because there are a lot of lessons of that border conflict that are very applicable to the conflicts we're at today and those that we may see in the future. And it's always good to understand those long simmering conflicts that for a variety of reasons may be tertiary as people look at their military history. And we have an ideal guest who spent a lot of time and has a great passion on the subject for the full hour. Our guest will be Lieutenant Jack McCain, United States Navy. Lieutenant McCain is a helicopter pilot with operational experience in Guam, Japan, Brunei, the Persian Gulf, and the Western Pacific. He's a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. He is currently assigned as an instructor at the U.S. Naval Academy. As with all of our guests on active duty or in government service, just a reminder that all the opinions and observations that Lieutenant McCain may have today are just those and don't represent the U.S. government or the Department of Defense. Jack, welcome back to Midrats.
Sal, Eagle One, it's wonderful to be here. I sincerely appreciate being invited on a second time, and I'm exceedingly happy that I get to talk about a subject of which I'm very passionate about.
I think that's great because it's reading some of the work you've done on it. It is just, it's a reminder that these modern conflicts, they have so much to teach us. And many times we find ourselves at all three levels of conflict, tactical, operational, or strategic, where we get blindsided or we just miss something. And then you stumble into a topic area, you start reading about, and you see something that you're just staring at, and you go, you know, if the right person had just known this 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road, How could that affect decision making? And there's so much here that we're, I'm glad we have an hour to touch on some of the issues that you brought up in your work on the topic. But for our listeners, I wanted to just kind of set the table, because this is one of those interesting items that you find in the back of history's closet that when you pull out, it's unfamiliar, but it's very familiar as well because of the issues it raises. So if you could take a little bit and describe for the listeners what countries were involved in the South African border war and what time frame bookended the conflict.
Absolutely. So if you're to try to define the border war itself by time, you can start in 1966, which was the initial South African involvement. They actually made an attack with the South African Air Force and the South African Police Service, funny enough, into Angola to try to put down some of the insurgents that had been waging a low-grade war inside Angola. The conflict stretched really until 1989 as the apartheid regime was beginning to be dismantled and as the Cubans had finally pulled out of Angola itself. So that's kind of the time boundedness of it. But in terms of who was involved, South Africa, obviously, Namibia, which at the time was known as Southwest Africa, it was basically a colonial possession of South Africa. Angola, of course. You had Zambia, which was a nation that was had fallen early in the National Liberation Wars and was a Marxist-Leninist state supportive of insurgents in both Angola and in then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. You had the United States get involved at various times, mostly through covert action programs. You had China involved. You had Portugal involved. You had Russia involved heavily. And you had Cuba. This was Cuba's largest military intervention in its history. And really, Castro kind of bet the farm on it, which I'm sure we'll get to. And that's just kind of the general players. Every major nation in Africa at some time claimed support for or assisted in some way either the insurgents or the South African side. So it, much like any conflict in Africa, is difficult to define specifically when it started, when it ended. But I choose 1966, which was basically the first shots fired by South Africa, and 1989 for its end.
Well, let's talk about why South Africa cared about what happened in Namibia or those adjacent, or what was formerly Southwest Africa. What difference does it make to them what happened to that country?
So we have a tendency to forget, especially the events that happened in Africa, because there's a very kind of convenient narrative that wars of national liberation were going on. They were anti-colonialist, and in some way or another, they all were. But many of the nations that were in revolt were Marxist-Leninist in nature, supported by either the Soviet Union or China. And this was obviously a big problem in the Cold War because you had nations that were trying to avoid becoming Marxist-Leninist that had to wage insurgencies or had to wage counterinsurgencies. So South Africa's interest obviously had to do with the fact that their colonial possession was under attack from across the border. Southwest Africa, now Namibia, had a couple of organizations working in its northern border between Angola and Namibia that were destabilizing the political situation, attacking farmers, attacking villages, conscripting kind of the locals into their forces. So they had an insurgency on one hand in Namibia, and they wanted to maintain Namibia as a buffer state because it separates Angola and South Africa. So they had more of a strategic interest in maintaining Namibia as it was. But in terms of what happened in Angola, they were primarily concerned about it falling to Marxism, Leninism. This was a huge fear of the South Africans, because if you look at the map and look at their strategic situation as the time went on, especially after 1979, when Rhodesia fell to Robert Mugabe's forces and became then Zimbabwe, they were surrounded on almost all sides by Marxist-Leninist states or states that were leaning towards that. They were also fighting a civil war inside their own country, and they were involved in not just the border area between Namibia and Angola, but were involved in Mozambique. They had attacked into Zambia. So they were fighting a war on many, many fronts, especially inside. So they had a keen interest in limiting the size and scope of Marxism-Leninism in sub-Saharan Africa.
When I think of the war, and when I was reading your paper, I was having flashbacks to the Reagan era in the 1980s when I first became aware of it. Part of it had to do with a female South African I knew, but that's a different story for a different day. But what really came to mind, she was a good swimmer. But what really came to mind was somebody who looks very differently. Is I remember seeing on the news the Reagan administration had brought together, which, depending upon your political point of view, was either the bar scene at Star Wars or was a collection of freedom fighters. It was sitting around the table. You had a leader of the Contras. You had a few representatives of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And then you had this big man with a big smile on his face representing UNITA. And they were kind of, you know, putting together their gallery of anti-communist forces. And, of course, I'm talking about Savimbi. If you could outline some of the major personalities and players in the border conflict that, you know, in American context, it's hard to understand that these people didn't go anywhere after 2 years or 4 years, and many of them are still with us, and how those personalities helped shape the conflict.
Absolutely. So I'll start with, you mentioned Savimbi, and he's quite an interesting character. He was finally killed in, I believe, 2004, fighting continually for representation for UNITA in Angola's government. So he was an insurgent for his entire career, but he was the anti-communist, pro-capitalist, I guess you would say, freedom fighter in Angola. At various times, he was supported by the U.S. and the South Africans, was actually a pretty good warrior in terms of how he waged war. He was very intelligent. He was actually quite methodical and was able to hold on through basically a sheer force of will through mid-60s all the way to 2000. So he helped shape the whole anti-communist fight, and was a major ally of the South African and the Reagan administration into the 80s. So you had two prime ministers of South Africa that really shaped it. You had Jan Vorster and F.W. de Klerk. Vorster was a little less bellicose, I guess would say, knew that there was a conflict, knew that they needed to protect South African interests in sub-Saharan Africa. But it was really P.W. Botha, who was, in fact, there's a book written about him called The Imperial Presidency, because he was a very almost bellicose. In fact, when apartheid was collapsing, he got on television and was sort of ranting. So he's remembered very interestingly. But one thing he did do was he understood the utility of sound military strategy and listened to his generals quite a bit, and helped shape strategy in the best way possible. Because you have to remember, unlike Angola, unlike SWAPO, which was Southwest African People's Organization, the insurgents in Namibia, South Africa was fighting under embargo. And they had to invent tactics, techniques, procedures, design weapon systems, and shape their strategy to fit the fact that they were under embargo, they were very politically unpopular, understandably, had almost no allies that would say out loud that they were allies. So it complicated the strategic situation, and P.W. Bolte was a lot of things, but he was a sound strategist. You, of course, had Jimmy Carter, who was very pro liberation, national liberation movement. So he did not do the South Africans many favors. And when Reagan came in, he was obviously staunchly anti-communist and understood Angola is a place full of oil, natural resources, one of the richest nations on the continent, in fact, and understood that Russia or communist nations having a toehold in Angola could tip the balance, the strategic balance, against capitalist forces in Africa. So you had Reagan as well. I don't have to mention that you had the Soviet prime minister or the Soviet party chief. You had Mao for a little while. You had later Chinese leaders. And you had a kind of an alphabet soup of insurgent forces. MPLA is now the governing body in Angola, but the MPLA was the main kind of offensive force supported by the Cubans. You had UNITA, which was under Savimbi. You had SWAPO, which had various leaders throughout its history. And I think I might be overcomplicating it, but suffice to say, there was not a lack of interest in this particular conflict, because the implications of loss on either side were really staggering.
Well, we've touched on it a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, the way I've read your paper was that the key to South Africa's success was they had a strategic vision of what they wanted things to look like when the fighting was done. And then they employed tactics that took into account the limitations they faced. Well, let's talk a little bit about their strategic vision, and we're going to get back to this again because one of the things you've done in this paper is point out that the world has spun many times since this war, and sometimes the situation we find ourselves in don't necessarily have that kind of, or don't seem to have a strategic vision that would help us engage in such activities as South Africans did. So just a little bit of Clausewitzian discussion on strategic vision and how that leads to the tactics that they employed.
Absolutely. So the South Africans had a very coherent strategic narrative that they wanted to stick to. Their number one priority was avoiding Namibia from becoming a hostile Marxist-Leninist state. Namibia was their colonial possession. It was their buffer state in between them and some other very hostile nations. And they had resource interests in Namibia.
Jack, let me interrupt you there for a second. How did Namibia become a colonial state of South Africa? That's a good thing to know before we go much further.
So it was a result of the end of World War One. Actually, South Africa was a nominal British possession. Southwest Africa at the time was a German possession. And through diplomatic dealings in several decades, actually, it ended up becoming the possession of South Africa. And it was just called Southwest Africa. It was in the beginning of the war, it was an apartheid state modeled after South Africa. It did have a kind of weird British influence in it. It was a little more British for whatever reason. And yes, like I said, it became the de facto colonial possession of South Africa.
Okay, sorry for the interruption. Now go on. Let's talk about the strategic vision of the South Africans.
Absolutely. Okay, so like I said, priority one for them was keep Namibia from becoming a hostile Marxist state. But in order to do this, it required a very kind of almost a diplomatic and military ballet, because strategic goal number two was maintain political support at home and I say sometimes abroad, not necessarily always abroad, because there were times where the South Africans thumbed their nose at the international order and said, you know what, we're tired of dealing with you. But they really were worried about political support at home and abroad. By at home, I mean the more South Africans that came home in body bags, because this was a conscript army, the less political support there was going to be for a Vietnam-style war in a place that didn't really matter a huge amount to the South African, the average South African day in and day out, unless obviously they were on national service. So it does have, the when it's looked at today, it is kind of described as South Africa's Vietnam because few people want to remember it. It still has very negative connotations because it was seen as a war in support of the apartheid state, which it was. South Africa was an apartheid state. So they needed to maintain sound political support amongst themselves and then as best they could abroad. Once they were under embargo and there was really nothing else that could be done, that went out the window a little bit. So they really were more worried about maintaining political support at home. They wanted to keep the insurgency at bay in order to allow a political process to emerge in Namibia and hopefully to them in Angola. They wanted to basically keep Marxism-Leninism at bay long enough to institute elections, and then they hoped that UNITA would ultimately win, although that didn't actually happen at the end of the war. I can describe their operational approaches a little later, but strategically, those were their three main goals.
I find units interesting and unit histories interesting from maybe spending a little bit too much time with Army folks. But I wanted to give you the opportunity to flesh out one of the units, the 32nd Battalion. Who was the 32nd Battalion? What did they do during the conflict? And what makes them interesting?
Okay. So I actually devoted quite a bit of space in my piece to the 32 Battalion. They are very controversial for reasons that I will get into. But what they were, if the U.S. had to define them, they would be an unconventional warfare unit with the intent of being by, with, and through, emphasis on the with, as a fighting force. They were never officially part of the South African military, depending on who you ask. But the idea was they took some of their best officers, special operations types, or guys that had proved themselves as officers, and fitted them with enemy weapons, enemy equipment. They even ate enemy rations, used enemy boots, and also took captured former insurgents. So somebody from the MPLA that was captured, they would basically sit them at a table and offer them, look, you have two choices. You can go to jail the rest of your life as a terrorist, or we will feed you, train you, clothe you, give you money, medical care, and support for your family if you have one, and you can fight for us. And a remarkable, in fact, a staggering number of former insurgents not only said yes, but they became the most effective unit in the South African border war. Every time they were called on to do sometimes nearly impossible jobs, they were highly effective at it because they had that expertise of being former insurgents. They were very aggressive. And the operational concept really was developed by a guy named Jan Breffenbach, which is a mouthful, but he was a Special Forces colonel, seems to have been a colonel his entire career for some reason. But his idea was that he wanted to out-terrorize the terrorists. He wanted to take a group that would go in, wipe out an entire insurgent camp, and many times they did it and took every stitch of clothing, equipment, body, so that it would look like the encampment had simply disappeared, and wage a an insurgent war against the insurgents, all inside Angola, which was in violation of international law at the time. So it's this really interesting composite of unconventional warfare, but you have former insurgents who are now on your side. And it was a model that worked really, really well for the South African military. And one of the first things that, after apartheid had ended, one of the first things Nelson Mandela did was to disband the unit because they were so feared for their abilities that it was really time to get rid of them. Unconventional warfare unit is a broad definition that doesn't fit well, but it does work for U.S. military purposes.
Yeah, I was fascinated by lots of things in your work, and one of them was that I had no idea that over the time period involved, or part of the time period involved, that Cuba had over 350,000, had rotated 350,000 troops through the area, and also that there was this the largest, I think you said, armor battle since El Alamein, and could you kind of discuss that and how that came to be?
Absolutely. So the battle that you're talking about is called the Battle of Cuito Cunevale. One of the toughest things about researching this subject in particular is neither side really wants to admit that they won or lost. The Cubans, after they made what they would probably describe as a tactical withdrawal out of Angola, had not accomplished any of their strategic objectives, and really was kind of a humiliating defeat for them, or at least I would characterize it as a defeat. But the South Africans didn't really win either. So it's research is a very difficult task with this conflict in particular because it is very highly propagandized on both sides. So what it was, centered around a place called the Cuito River, the city of Cuito Cunevale, and the Cubans wanted to wipe out UNITA in one fell swoop. So they had landed over a period of a few years well over 150 T-55 tanks, Mi-24s, MiG-21s, and a vast number of troops. They were almost entirely under the direct control of Castro. During the Battle of Cuito Cunevale, Castro was giving orders by telephone to his commanders on the ground, which didn't go too well. So you had a large mechanized force that was trying to push UNITA, basically destroy the force or move it out of its stronghold near the city of Cuito Cunevale. So the South Africans wanted to stop this. UNITA was their dog in that fight, and they wanted to blunt the Cuban offensive, humiliate the Cubans if possible, but they had no interest in capturing territory because they knew it was unfeasible. They just wanted to stop the Cuban advance and keep UNITA alive. What ensued really is one of the most, I hate to use the word interesting because it's not very descriptive, but the most fiercely fought and the largest mechanized battle, as you said, since El Alamein on the African continent. But the South Africans were not using tanks. They were using an infantry fighting vehicle called a Rattel, R-A-T-E-L. And I had talked to a former infantry officer who had been there in the 61st Mechanized Infantry Battalion, and he reminded me what it was like to go up against tanks in infantry fighting vehicles. The South Africans were very good with this concept of what I would characterize a light cavalry. They have a history of doing it all the way through both Boer Wars, and that kind of light, fast, mobile operational concept tied with great accuracy and officers with great skill really carried through to this particular battle and is really apparent because the South Africans were outnumbered, depending on who you ask, probably outnumbered by 3-1, maybe more, maybe 4-5-1, depending on whose numbers you trust. So they're greatly outnumbered by a superior force with superior firepower that did not have the South Africans did not have command of the air at all. And they were deep inside enemy territory. But they made a lightning-fast approach, engaged the Cubans, which would seem almost suicidal, an infantry fighting vehicle, against the main battle tank. But they used light infantry, or light cavalry tactics against the tanks, would pin them up, put them into a fire zone, and tear them apart. It was a resounding tactical victory for the South Africans, but it was a kind of a strategic draw on both sides. The Cubans talk about this in reverent tones as if it was the greatest victory that the Cubans had ever won. I don't find that to be supported by evidence, just kind of Cold War-style propaganda. But it was a big bloody nose for Castro and was the last time that he would make an adventure outside of Cuba.
I think when you fold in their, as you described, their tactical success at the conventional level, but also the performance of the 32nd Battalion, and when you look at the disparity of forces and the constraints and restraints that the South Africans had put on themselves or were put on them, one thing that I think draws out, in my mind at least, is something in the profession of arms that always comes forward when you're looking at actual performance on the battlefield, that numbers are important. Who has the most of item A or B is important. But it really, in many cases, and I think the performance of the 32nd Battalion is a good example of that, a lot of it has to do with leadership, philosophy, training, and the ethos of an organization and how they fight. And the South African, they have the Boer background from the Boer Wars, also British influence. But when you look at the leadership philosophy, the leadership traditions, and the ethos of the South African forces as was demonstrated during the Boer War, what from an American point of view and concept do you think would look very familiar? But did you discover something there with the South Africans that, if not unique, is at least something that defines them and breaks them apart from what you might expect?
Yeah. I put a lot of thought into that exact subject as I was trying to write this piece. And one of the things that really strikes me, first of all, is the level to which the basic soldier, whether they were going to be a cook or whether they were going to be a leg infantryman, they were trained to an incredibly high level with really severe discipline, in fact. Boot camp was a very unpleasant place, regardless of what your what we would call an MOS or what your specialty was going to be out there in the South African Defense Force. So, and the officers' courses, officers were picked from the ranks, either standouts in boot camp or soldiers that had distinguished themselves. So they were brought into an officer's course, an officer leadership course, and that was even more strenuous and more difficult. So they had a high standard to which they held the individual soldier, both physically, mentally, and it was a pretty grueling process from everything I've read to go through boot camp. So I would say that obviously the level of fitness in individuals, but the leadership mentality was not prescriptive by any stretch of the imagination. It was very proscriptive. Combatant commanders on the ground were given wide latitude to fight as they saw fit. Interesting ideas such as the 3-2 Battalion were tried out, and the ones that succeeded stayed alive. The ones that didn't stay alive. So you had an empowered, even at the junior officer level, an empowered core of NCOs, officers, all the way up through general officers, who kind of knew the stakes, but were given the ability to prosecute the war as they saw fit. I think that you'll see a couple of times, especially at the Battle of Cuita Cunivale, that the South Africans wish they would have had their tanks, obviously. The tank battalion was held back before the fight broke out, much to the chagrin of the infantrymen. But I would say the level of empowerment, the kind of lack of this top-down leadership, it was a very organic process and with empowered commanders and empowered junior officers. This, I touched on it before, but this idea of a light cavalry, if you know anything about the history of the Boers, they had invented the idea of, they called them commandos, light horsemen that waged a war against the British that to them was unwinnable until they used scorched earth tactics, rounded up the soldiers' families and put them into concentration camps and basically starved them to death. So the commando concept, this fast attack, lightly armed, but also very accurate, permeated the mechanized infantry, but also the rest of the infantry. They had excellent paratroopers, and their special forces were second to none on the continent. And you still see these gentlemen who fought in the South African border war as special operations guys out there in private military contracting organizations. One of their special operations pilots, a guy named Niall Ellis, is actually, he's still in Afghanistan flying today. I think he's about 70 years old. So they have this kind of intrinsic aptitude for the military, it seems, because their soldiers have continued to be pervasive and sought after for their abilities. In even today in Nigeria, there's a unit comprised of former South African soldiers in Nigeria. I don't know if they're still there. It's kind of a confluence of all sorts of interesting things that made them this fantastic force. I'm not doing enough of it justice, but really, I'd say the big contributors were empowered junior officers and mid-grade officers, as well as general officers, and this history of light cavalry. And the ability, the basic ability to use a rifle was also pretty apparent. A lot of these guys grew up hunting. The Afrikaners are known for being pretty hardy people, so they were familiar with marksmanship, how to hit a moving target, and that helped kind of make both their special operations and conventional forces adept.
Well, I was also interested in the, we would call it COIN now, but the group that, I'm not going to try and pronounce the South African name for them, the Crowbar group. Could you kind of talk about them a little bit and how that fit into the great scheme here of how they ran, the South Africans ran their forces?
Yeah, absolutely. So Crowbar in Afrikaans is pronounced Kofoot. And what this was not a military organization. It was a police force. So the South Africans drew on policemen from both the South African police and the Southwest African police, as well as former SWAPO generally insurgents, to make this, you could probably call it a flying column maybe, but it was an operational concept that took armored vehicles, which are the exact same as what an MRAP today, they were called Kostas, and they would patrol along the border. They were very, very heavily armed, so 50 cal, 20 millimeter cannons. Each individual soldier was heavily armed with rifle and grenades, and they would hunt insurgents the same way that you would hunt wild game in Africa. And doing so, they're either on a horse or a truck. In this case, they'd be on the MRAP. And they would have trackers up front, basically running, looking for signs of insurgents, footprints, broken limbs, doing, like I said, the same way you would track an animal. And the trackers would rotate. When one would get tired, a new one would come up, and they would chase the insurgents down faster than the insurgents could run away. So they would close with the enemy and, in so many words, cut them to pieces. it's a very controversial, for a lot of good reasons, unit, because they, near the middle of the conflict, the policemen and the former insurgents were given bounties for each insurgent killed, weapons captured or destroyed. So it incentivized killing insurgents, which comes with its own connotation. But they were very effective because they never allowed the insurgent forces to get comfortable where they were. They would also use, as policemen, they would use investigative tactics. They'd go to a village. Some would interrogate, some would just talk. It kind of depends on the tactical situation. And they would ask the villagers, have you seen any SWAPO? Do you know any? Or just kind of get the general sense of what was going on. Sometimes it was obvious that military age males were around, despite the fact they weren't armed. And they would use that intelligence, that tactical intelligence, to move on insurgent forces. The same sort of idea, high-speed commando. They were equipped in shorts and T-shirts, basically, and kept the press on the enemy, and were engaged. They'd go out for a couple of weeks, and they would engage every day, if not multiple times a day. So it was very taxing. The police officers and insurgents would rotate in and out, but it was a very effective tool. The moniker Crowbar was meant to pry the insurgents away from the population or out of the population. We would probably define that today as enemy-centric counterinsurgency warfare, because they were not concentrating on winning hearts and minds. They had some minor hearts and minds programs, and this was really a lack of focus and lip service paid to it throughout all the South African forces. But they were very good at closing with and destroying the enemy.
I wanted to, if you could indulge me a bit, the advantage of a long format show, because your work isn't readily available to our listeners. I wanted to pull out a longish quote from you that I'd hope you'd flesh out a little bit, because I found myself going back to read it, and I think you've got another 300 pages just in this quote here to flesh out. It's really right to the point. So let me quote you to you. And then have you a chance to maybe flesh out the ideas you brought. Beginning of long quote. What is also made abundantly clear in the South African example and its contemporary American counterpart is that the integrity of strategic decision-making process between civilian leaders and the military leaders is of paramount importance. To wage a war correctly requires more than a civilian leader simply giving policy marching orders to the military. However, the military also cannot simply remain comfortable hiding behind apoliticism. Leaving politics to the politician relegates military decision-making to purely military considerations, which is only a single aspect of war. Strategic decision-making is a two-way street, and whereas politicians have no problem making military decisions, military leaders have been eager to stay in their military lane. Military leaders should rightly avoid partisan politics, but not politics entirely, and statesmen should do more than take occasional unequal advice from military leaders. Regardless of the size or scope, war is an all-encompassing phenomenon that requires constant reevaluation. Both civilian and military leaders should do well to recognize that fact. While a full critique of the Afghan-Iraqi wars is outside the scope of this document, their legacy should be considered carefully as a lesson in the breakdown of civil-military dialogue and the misuse of middle-range theories of strategy. The South African border war represents a useful counterexample for such consideration, but in order to be successful in future wars, it is the United States that must change. War, regardless of scale, is the all-encompassing national act of force in an effort to compel your enemy to do your will. An enemy should be expected to make every effort to undermine, disrupt, and ruin your strategic plans, requiring constant reassessment at every level. And whereas the military may physically do the fighting, it is the state that decides to go to war, wages the war, and finishes it. Neither policymakers nor any member of the U.S. military should forget that fact. End of long quote. That's right, then, in center mass there, Jack. What were you thinking about, centrally in that quote? And do you have additional thoughts that could flesh out?
So to answer that, by the way, you weren't getting long quotes. it really encompasses what I was trying to get at wholly with this piece, because when I started, I was very excited about writing about hybrid war, because hybrid war and gray zone operations has been on the tip of every military analysis tongue for 5 or 10 years, maybe even longer, as this all encompassing boogeyman of future operations. So I wanted to get my own piece of that pie. The more I did research and the more I tried to find a coherent definition, the less useful it became. And when in my research, I found 33 different types of warfare. So that's what I'm getting to with the particulars of that trying to define warfare into a type. This is a counterinsurgency war, or this is a hybrid war, this is a cyber war, take your pick, misses the point. To make coherent strategy, you can't just box a war or a conflict into one label, apply counterinsurgency doctrine 1-5, and then, wash your hands up. The military likes doing this because we're very doctrinaire. We like clear guidelines. We do not like operating in uncertainty, but it's uncertainty in that doctrine in which the enemy thrives. Kind of to get to the more ethereal, I guess, if you want to call it that, what I was getting at here is the civil-military dialogue is of prime importance in the ability of a state and of a military to make coherent strategy. That civil-military dialogue, at least through the research that I've done, in my opinion, has broken down in the last several or few administrations. I would probably coin this as civilian command of the military vice civilian control of the military. It is not the job of a policymaker to give orders to a military, a general strategy maker. It is the job of the general to let the policymaker know what is possible, because all strategy has to be attacked from the realm of the possible. And you see this especially with Afghanistan. Instead of shaping a coherent strategy with which we prosecute the war, we have some really fuzzy goals that we're trying to accomplish. We want to change what is now the government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan to a less corrupt, more legitimate system. We want to make the Afghan military capable of standing on its own legs. But we have under-resourced, most definitely. We have also under-assessed the ability to make these things happen. I don't take a pot shot at the military by saying they simply sit behind their apoliticalness, but there is a definite fear of delving into politics of any type, but warfare is a political action. And so simply sitting at the operational level and staying there and avoiding political discourse makes the process less than informed. When you don't have an equal, or at least a more equal, dialogue between policymakers and the military, you are not going to get the reality on the ground. You are not going to get the ability to make coherent strategy, because military generals and military officers are not supposed to be consulted for advice once in a while. They are supposed to be an integral part of the process of making strategy, not an advisor. I'm not here advocating that the U.S. military needs some sort of general staff or that civilian control of the military is bad, because it's not. But the military needs to be more equal. If you take this back in history and look at World War II, you see individuals like Marshall or like King who were in the White House. They were the highest ranking, if you want to call it that. They were the most influential military officers when it came to policy, and they were very much acting at the political level. In fact, when King took over, he said that he didn't want anybody to oppose him and kind of packed before the Pentagon, kind of packed the Navy Yard with, I hate to say yes men, but people that were going to help execute his strategy. He was not apolitical, but he was nonpartisan. And this is a distinction that, to me, has really broken down. The difference between political and partisan is not defined anymore. And generals and admirals are disabled from being able to take a more active and necessary role in strategy making.
Well, as a Vietnam guy, since I'm really old, the lack of a strategic vision has been around for more than a couple of years. And you know, it's a painful process. But did it help South Africa that its national survival was at stake, as opposed to the situation we occasionally find ourselves in, where we're engaged in what seem to be large punitive expeditions more than necessarily a strategic war?
I think that there's definitely an element to that. Now, I will say that overall, the political ability of South Africa to sustain apartheid was both abhorrent. You cannot subjugate a people inside your own country. But it was unsustainable. There was no way that apartheid was going to prevail. And I think near the end of the war, the South African policymakers understood that. I think that's an important point to make. But, you know, inside South Africa, from the research I've done, people really didn't believe that if Angola fell, it was going to somehow threaten South Africa. There just was not that narrative. This was the 60s and 70s and on into the 80s, where the sentiment was very anti-war. The sentiment was very anti-apartheid. The sentiment was very anti-South African in the international realm. And people really wanted to see these wars of national liberation. They want to see these groups self-actualize and groups to be able to govern their own nation. So the sentiment really was against the war for the majority of the time it was waged, and people saw it as undermining the credibility of the South African state, which it really did quite handily. So I do think that there was a little more than maybe we have with Afghanistan or Iraq that they might have viewed as more of an existential threat, but I wouldn't oversell that. It was less apparent, at least in my research. I could be completely wrong, but it was not billed as this huge existential fight.
There was a theory during the Cold War that was poo-pooed, but I think time is pretty much laid out to be true. As we started the show mentioning, you know, two of the things that were going on together was the era of decolonization and also the Cold War. And a lot of these wars of national liberation, whether it was the sole force or part of a popular front, the communists were heavily involved in. And there was a theory that for many, not all, of course, but for many of these conflicts and many of these leaders of national liberation movements, they were more what we would perhaps today call nationalist movements, part of the post-colonial move to get the former colonizers out. And they were communists simply because that was the best way to get money, resources, and support. And indeed, when the Soviet Union finally fell, you saw a lot of these organizations. Over the course of time, the Marxist-Leninist Communist part just kind of faded away along with the Soviet Union. And if you look at Angola today, because of that national resource, it's not North Korea. When you look at the Namibia and Angola, and if you want to, South Africa today, do you think that they would be where they are if the South Africans did not succeed in their limited war gains during the border war?
So this is a very complex question, and revisionist history is tough, but I'll absolutely give you my opinion that I've kind of garnered through research. So to see the difference between the idea of Marxism-Leninism and how it would have played out, I do think that the character of these nations would be very different if the South Africans had not opposed the way they did, especially in Namibia, most importantly. After the war was over in Angola, And after the Soviet Union fell, the MPLA almost immediately shrugged off the mantle of Marxism-Leninism. It was no longer necessary. There was absolutely a tactical, operational, and strategic almost necessity for aligning a popular liberation movement, aligning itself with the Soviet Union, because it gave them, just as you said, money, weapons, support, and it was not a hard sell. Most of the international community was staunchly against colonialism. I don't necessarily think they thought through what would happen, you know, second, third, fourth, and fifth order effects of what would happen. But had the South Africans not waged the war the way they did, I think that the character would be different. I don't necessarily think they'd be North Korea, but Robert Mugabe has certainly done, sarcastically we'll say, a good job with now Zimbabwe, former Rhodesia. He's run what was once the breadbasket of Africa into the ground through his redistributionist policies. Now, one thing that did happen was, because of this war, because of the heavy South African involvement and the loss of international credibility, it allowed the ANC to rise and really enabled the peaceful transition of power from the apartheid government to the ANC. A lot of that had to do with the personalities involved, especially Nelson Mandela. So kind of on the converse, if they hadn't have fought the war, apartheid may have gone on longer, and it may have been a much more violent transition if it hadn't have gone the way it did in the mid-90s. And there was still violence, mostly on the part of a group called the AWB. But because there had been so much blood and treasure spent, I think that it really shaped the way that South Africa would become the nation that it is today.
Speaking of which, the what's the Peace and Reconciliation group? What has been their attitude toward the people who fought for South Africa against the Angolans and the Namibian forces and all those folks?
So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was really handed at the behest of Nelson Mandela sought to not to punish. In fact, there were really only two people that were punished because of it, but sought to, hey, all we want to do is know exactly what happened. Everyone tells the truth so that we can begin to heal as a nation. It was a brilliant move. It really facilitated the peaceful transition of power. The ability of both sides, there were atrocities committed on both sides of what became the South African Civil War. And I think that the popular view now is shifting a little bit. The ANC is losing power in South Africa. They're not as popular as they once were. Mostly that's due to Jacob Zuma is the current president of South Africa, the head of the ANC, and he's quite corrupt. Nelson Mandela was seen as incorruptible, but Zuma built himself a very large house at government expense and has had kind of these notable corruption issues. So I think today the Truth and Reconciliation Commission may be looked at favorably, but the ANC has been using more divisive language, and that has hurt the kind of soul-searching in South Africa about the border war. There have been some recent movies that have come out that show it as the border war is a mixed bag, which is probably the best way it can be remembered. But the ANC has not done the veterans much of a service, really, because I think there's this a view that the ANC has mismanaged the South African military because it went from a NATO quality force to the South African military now is a shadow of its former self. So it's very nuanced. It's a very complicated issue, but the border war directly affects the way policy is made in the South African military today.
Interesting that you mentioned what's happening with the ANC power politics and the growth of their alternative party. I think that's something everybody who cares about South Africa needs to keep a close eye on, because as that dividing line, to get off topic a little bit, as that power dividing line starts to shift to ANC losing more and more power, I think their reaction is going to be even more non-democratic than what we've already seen, unless they have the right people with the right attitude take power from Zuma and his acolytes. I think it's going to be an incredibly important thing to watch over the course of the next decade. But getting back to your work here, Jack, first of all, it's been a very quick hour, a very fast hour. Thoroughly enjoyed it. If the listener wanted to get the full view of your work on South Africa, the border war, is there any opportunity it might be available online? And if not, are there some authors or some books or some publications on the topic that you would recommend to them?
Absolutely. So my work is actually at a publisher right now. It's being turned into, I hate to call it a book because it's really not that long, but a monograph if you want to use a flowery term. So it should be published hopefully February, March timeframe. The foreword is being written right now, and it will be available on Amazon and Kindle in regular format and Kindle format. But if I were to recommend books, there's a fantastic one by a guy named Leopold Schultz called The SADF in the Border War. It is the all-encompassing document that covers the border war from end to end, but also does a good job of covering the strategic decision-making process of the war. It's a bit dry, but it's excellent in terms of research. If you want to learn specifically about the Battle of Kawito Kune Vale, there's a book called The Cold War Turns Hot, and it's a big orange cover. I can't recall the author's name off the top of my head, but it's written from a more Cuban perspective. The author is a little more sympathetic towards the Cubans than I give them credit for. It's excellently written, details the battle itself. And that particular battle is, to me, very interesting because it is a conventional and unconventional fight all rolled into one and kind of displayed the abilities of the South African Defense Force at their peak. There are several other books. Many of them are not published in the U.S. So if you basically go on Amazon and Google South African Border War, you'll be able to find a couple of the titles. But I'm hoping myself to add to this because there's just not enough written on it, and it's not well enough understood, or not as well understood as it should be for how important it was.
Well, excellent. We will keep an eye open for that. And for the listener, when Jack's work becomes available, we'll go ahead and link to it. And I want to thank everybody for joining us. And, Jack, I wish you and your lovely expanding family a great holiday season, Christmas, and New Year.
Sal Eagle One, thank you so much for having me on. It was a great evening. I sincerely appreciate it.
Really enjoyed it, Jack. Happy holidays to you and your family.
Happy holidays as well.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us live or with us on the archive. And I wish everybody, again, a great Christmas, New Year's. And we will see you in the new year. And until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
It's a long way to Tipperary.